author of Context, Caroline Casey. So a few weavings of context before I bring in our splendid guest in a moment, Caroline. We welcome Lila Philip, author of Beaverland, contributing to our series, The Intelligence of Our Flora, Fauna, Fungi Kingdom, Dedicated Voices Guiding Our Rogue Species to Collaborative Humility. It is a consummate history and guide to our ingenious kin, beaver people, their travails and resilient return, who fireproof our landscape. So we'll come right back to that. But first, here we are, just full moon tide, the moon occulted Mars, which is a wonderful thing to see. I caught a glimpse with the Pleiades. We go, ooh, truly we live in a storytelling creation. And Raphael Warnock, what a great human. We think of him as our black gospel King Arthur, senator mentor, and he said upon being elected, a vote is a prayer, faith in action. Democracy is the political enactment of a spiritual idea that we are each created with a spark of the divine. He referenced High John the Conqueror, the great folk hero of the South, got to find a way out of no way. And then he said, I am the land. Oh, that's so great. And just for serious fun envisioning, we see Mike Tyson escorting Herschel Walker backstage for entheotherapy to heal his concussions, restore kinship, and a sense of belonging to a larger wolf. Yes, great stories about Mike Tyson, who says, I was concussed, and I was crazy, and I treated women badly, and then I found psilocybin mushrooms and cannabis, and he goes on. There's just, if you Google it, there's a lot there. So perfect. We go, over there. Right, nothing more crucial for our rogue species but to have manners whereby we humbly cooperate with nature's guiding genius to mend our collaborative treaties across species borders, to have respect, which means to look again, respect. You know, we say animism, not a belief, just good manners. And then just in the good news, Brittany Griner on her way home, alleviating part of our collective cruelty. So we align with Trickster's intelligence of necessary miracles. If we just approach the world with reverent curiosity that our guest embodies, what's your story? Why then we humans would rejoin the choreography of creation and be okay citizens. There we go. So briefly, we are in Fun Drive. I'm just going to announce this briefly to magnetize people, and then we will dive into a proper show. But we are offering the splendid, splendid book. You will hear Beaverland, How One Weird Rodent Made America by Lila Philip. That's for a pledge of $150. And then we have many, many, many things that I will announce more at the end of the show. I want to get to our guest. But we've also put together a really great, from our audio archives, The Intelligence of Our Flora, Fauna, Fungi Kingdom. It's two recordings with herbalist Stephen Buhner, who is on the edge of life and death. We salute his wonderful herbalist self, his life dedicated to increasing humans' respect for the intelligence of plants. We have four with mycologist Paul Stamets. I was his first radio show ever. We have Janine Benyus on biomimicry, Sally Cox on bonobos, Ben Coldfarb on beavers, Dan Flores on coyotes, Kristen Olsis with stories of generosity and cooperation. All of those things, that's for a pledge of $100. So much. By calling 1-800-439-5732 or online, kpfa.org. All right, there we go. So, yes, so this is a consummate history. And if again, we do want to approach the world with reverent curiosity. Our guest, Lila Philip, is the author of award-winning books of literary nonfiction that have received starred reviews and have been reviewed by the New York Times. A Guggenheim Fellow, she's been awarded fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and National Endowment for Humanities. She was a contributing columnist at the Boston Globe and teaches in the Environmental Studies program at the College of the Holy Cross, where she is a professor in the English department. Welcome, Lila.
Thank you so much. I'm so delighted to be with you.
That's very wonderful and kind. Well, you couldn't have a more welcoming venue. It's like, oh, so grateful for your book, so grateful for your book. And let me just, the blurbs which go on are fabulous reading, but let me just do two of them for, well, one. But Bill McKibben says, We can't have enough books about this wonderful creature, beavers, and this one is particularly strong on the remarkable history of the animal in our continent's history and imagination. A loud slap of the tail in approval. So, yes, and then that's wonderful. I want to talk about beaver, well, everything. And all of this, you know, and your offering and your dedication is within the context of human-caused massive disequilibrium. And you mentioned what added to the poignancy of your mother's death in February was the night spring peepers had come out, their haunting cries, right? You said that everything was blooming too early. Do you remember this part? Yeah?
Yes. Oh, yes, very much. Yeah. Gosh, there's so much to talk about. You just have to get me started. But anyway.
Oh, good. All right. Feel free.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, if I may, I just think beavers have so much to teach us. We have so much to learn from them. And, you know, before going to that moment, if I could just say for listeners a little bit about the book, because I may be just coming to it for the first time. You know, I've always been interested in the way humans interface with the natural world. And one day I witnessed beavers making a pond near my house, and it was one of the most incredible things I'd ever seen. And that, for me, was the start. And then I started learning about beavers and pretty quickly discovered that beavers literally shaped our country. So the first foundations of wealth came from beaver fur, and beavers, you know, just revved up the first engines of capitalism here. But it wasn't just our first economies. It was really, as I studied them, and I write about this in depth in the book, I discovered that North America really is beaver land, because beavers literally shaped our continent, the watersheds, our geology, not to mention, you know, the forests that would develop. We're all influenced by the beavers over millennia. And what I came to realize writing this book is that beavers, this wonderfully weird rodent, now yes. has a fantastic role to play helping us deal with really the greatest crisis of our generation, which is climate change. And if I may just go on for a moment, I think,
yes,
you know, watching beavers make their pond was magic. It wasn't just the pond. It was the whole area was soon teeming with life. And I could describe that in scientific terms, and I'm happy to, as we go on, talk about the biodiversity and what actually is happening, because it's so cool. But it showed me how resilient the natural world is. And we need stories of hope and resiliency to help us face our collective future. And beavers have to be one of the greatest conservation success stories of the 20th century. So I just think they're an amazing story for us to think about in this moment and learn from. So to go back to the spring peepers.
Right. Well, yes. Well, that was just the poignancy of out of sync. I mean, even here on, well, we're both on the East Coast, outside D.C., you know, the weird spike of weather, 30 degrees, 70 degrees, you know, and it's everything's coming out, but there's no food for it, you know, and it's like, oh, we're very sorry. But yes, no, I was captivated immediately by your first sentence, beavers as sacred, if only for their deep weirdness. And it's like, yes. And there's so many great anecdotes, and then all the complexity. I will aspire to do many things too, but you have a wonderful, the author's local, Beaver Pond's wonderful map of Woodstock, Connecticut, founded in 1686. Excuse me. And I love, in fairy tales, Gioia Timpanelli says there's two main themes. One is careful living in a particular place. This beaver, this rock, this tree, this history. You know, and you say, even when you're talking with Herb the Trapper, you know, he says, I always study everything. We go, okay, right. So you're doing a great job of that. And the other poignancy of out of sync.
Yeah. So, no, thank you so much. That's such a great compliment. And I think, you know, we really need to reset our relationship to the natural world clearly. And I think that can become an overwhelming concept, but it's actually very simple. It's about paying deep attention. It's about doing exactly what you're talking about, just looking. And I think one of the things that so excited me about the beaver is that they are this completely ordinary miracle, if you will. I mean, they're so darn ordinary. They've been considered a pest and a nuisance, and there they've been doing this incredible work. So, you know, we know climate change is going to create far more devastating floods and fires, not to mention periods of extreme heat and drought, you know, everything being out of sync that you're mentioning. And the beaver can help us deal with these problems. So, you know, I discovered this in the book, and it's a lot of what I write about in the book, is how beavers can really help us in very concrete, direct ways. I think they can also help us in metaphoric ways, and I think we need to remember that the indigenous peoples who have always lived here have many, many stories throughout the continent, different peoples in different places that saw the beaver as a teacher. And I think I start the book with the story of Great Beaver for a particular reason. We can get into that if you want. It's a kind of environmental parable. But to go back to just kind of staving off the fear and paralysis that can happen in our time when we think of the problems we're facing, if we just take one of them, like drought, well, beavers will move into a creek and they'll build a dam, and that creek or stream will swell, and then they'll move down and do that again until pretty soon that creek or stream, seen from above, looks like a thread with all these beads almost on a chain. And so you have an area full of water, and that is just the water you can see, and then they build canals into the forest so that they have transportation to get woody material. So you have more water and more interaction between the water and the land, which is ecological health. And that's just what you can see. Meanwhile, underneath, the wetlands they are creating are these huge sponges that are there as a body of water that's being held to help us in times of drought, or a sponge to help us when we have the kind of extreme rain events we have in the Northeast. Instead of that rain tearing through the river system, ripping out the topsoil and flooding out into the ocean, it's slowed down and held. So, you know, study after study has shown, and there was a pioneer study in 2009 up in Canada that showed that beaver wetlands hold 9 times more water in times of drought than areas without beaver wetlands. So, you know, science is catching up to what I think many indigenous communities knew a long, long time ago. So if you think about the Blackfeet out in the northern arid territory, you know, areas of, say, Montana and northern parts of Canada, they had strict prohibitions against hunting beaver because they understood their environmental importance in keeping water in an arid landscape so there would be grass to feed the bison that they relied on for food. So, you know, beavers have always had this tremendously important role, and we've forgotten it, and we just need to remember it. And they're, you know, what's amazing is that they're out there. There are millions of highly trained engineers out in the woods ready to help us. So I think it's just such a great story.
Yeah, it is. No, ecological engineers, ecosystem engineers, that we're the only species, humans and beavers, that transform the landscape according to their desire. Ours, ecocidal, theirs, contributing to community well-being. But I also loved, I mean, your book is so far-reaching and ties everything together in so many ways. We will aspire to do it justice. But you also mentioned in Iran, in Persia, right? It was, yeah. You weren't supposed to kill beavers, and if you did, there were heavy fines, which you could alleviate by killing 1,000 snakes. So they clearly had preferences, right? But it's beavers in Iran, we didn't know until now.
Well, told us that. Yeah, I mean, sorry, you have to be careful. I get so excited talking about beavers.
No, no, go. No, your excitement is welcome. Go, yes, go.
But beavers were present throughout, you know, parts of Asia, Europe, at that time, they were sought highly for their castor scent, their scent glands, which were used for medicinal purposes. So beaver castor was thought to cure everything from headaches to insanity. I mean, it was highly prized. And so, you know, not hunting beaver wasn't actually environmental concern. That was because the castor was so valuable. I think it was more about poaching. And then later, they were, of course, prized for their fur. So beaver have these lustrous, lustrous coats. I mean, imagine a fur, a postage stamp-sized, you know, patch of beaver fur has something like 126,000 individual strands. That's about as much hair as is on an individual human's head. That's just in a little bitty patch of a beaver. So they have this incredibly lustrous fur that would make very warm coats, or more to the point, the underwool is slightly barbed. So it was discovered in about the 15th century that if they made a kind of felt out of that underwool, it made the most durable, incredible felt for hats. So it was like the Gore-Tex, of its era. There was nothing like beaver felt for being waterproof or durable, durable. So it was a really practical material that people used and overused. So, you know, that's the sad history of our resource extraction. So they wiped them out in Europe. And then when it was discovered, when the first cod fishermen came back from a fishing trip with some beaver pelts, Europe went nuts and they sent ships flying across the Atlantic. So, you know, our North America was literally not discovered, but the early explorations were all about the pursuit of beaver fur. It was incredibly valuable, and in the colonial period, it was the unit of currency, not gold, you know, the beaver dollar. It was the unit of trade. And then, you know, in the 19th century, the first big businessmen like John Jacob Astor would rev up the engines of capitalism, and they would become so efficient at hunting out the beaver that it wasn't long before they almost wiped the beaver out. So, well, luckily, yeah,
the Astor story is intriguing and ties us to everything too, because then you say he starts off and but he wants all of it, all the beaver trade. And then Lewis and Clark are set forth by Jefferson, and it's like all these childhood history memories are stirring, going, I remember that. And that's when Astor steps in, right, and says, because Jefferson says he doesn't have the money to do the outpost, and Astor steps in and goes, it's all mine, right?
Yeah. Well, he was brilliant and ruthless, and, you know, he wasn't going to follow any laws. He was going to break any. There really weren't that many laws back then. I mean, it was really a remarkable story to tell. And I also think I wanted to tell it fully because, you know, that is part of our American history, that kind of just unbridled,
greed.
Kind of greed of our natural resources. And, you know, the conversion of natural resources into power has always been the propelling force of empire. So Asia has spices and salt and silk, and the Atlantic rippled with cod. North America had the beaver. But I think we can't, you know, we're living with the consequences of that and here in North America. And I also think we can't understand who we are unless we understand the big forces that have shaped us. So I really felt, I'm not a historian, I'm not a trained scholar, I'm a storyteller, but I felt this is a big American story. And in the moment we're living in, we have to be fully honest and can't kind of gloss over what's uncomfortable just to get to the good parts. And, the good part is that, you know, we have this fantastic conservation efforts in the early 1900s that brought the beaver back. So, you know, concerted efforts were made first in New York in 1904 and 1905. They brought beaver back to the Adirondacks. They brought beaver to Connecticut in 1914. And, you know, people really, dedicated people thought about, you know, how are we going to bring our wildlife back? And it worked. And I mean, the most zany was probably that wonderful Idaho reintroduction program I talk about in 1948, where they parachuted beavers in,
Parachuted.
you know. So smart policies at the right time are also part of our legacy, and they can be part of our legacy going forward, you know. So I think we need to kind of own it all. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, you do a great job. And in my reading, I'm like, oh, and then we get to your ally, really, Herb the Trapper. And it's true, once that chapter starts, I was holding my breath. I'm like, oh, because it's hard, but you did it for us. You
Yeah.
went, to see. And I mean, I did live with a coyote for 19 years, so we'll get to the eccentrics who lived with beavers, right? So, and then the skinning of
Yeah.
coyotes. I'm like, well, but what you mentioned, sometimes we're just assigned to love a species. Right, like the gaze, you just and the beavers by your pond, and your sorrow when they left, and then their joy return. Sometimes we're just assigned that, and I think what your book does in your dedicated life is, if we can be advocates on behalf of the wild that we love in human culture, that's the best. And your book is very much like that. But it also all the big themes, you say beavers belong to an animal nation and had to be honored in death by most indigenous people. So it's not the killing, but it is the slaughter, right? And it's not so much the thing, but the manner of. And now we're back to respect, and and you do mention, they're a keystone species, and they're forest Shiva, and then I got to your the wonderful, quirky and complex chapter, Beaver Sprite,
Isn't that
Richard's
great?
memoir, My Years Building an Animal Sanctuary, which brings up a lot of things, because she lived
Yeah.
with beavers. I wish there was. I don't know if there's a photograph in your book. I was reading the PDF,
Yeah.
but of the
Oh,
woman
yeah.
with the 60. Oh, great. Okay, I need that
Oh,
book.
yeah.
With the
Oh,
60-pound beaver in her lap. I'm sorry. Say what?
Oh, sorry. There's a wonderful, I mean, I had a lot of fun curating and researching photographs for the book. In fact, I have an illustrated manuscript from Iran of
Oh.
beavers. I have illustrated bestiaries from 13th century. I really wanted to show how humans have fascinated the human imagination throughout history and in different geographies. But I have a picture of Dorothy Richards and Eager
Yes.
having tea at the table.
Yeah,
Eager has her
no,
carrots and Dorothy
I
has her
go for that.
tea.
But that, but then later in the book, you were talking to some people who knew her, and they were suggesting that the beavers might have been imprisoned against their will, even though she built them a swimming pool in her house. So that's a complex thing, right? We don't know if but it's this idea also of respectful interaction. I mean, when I lived with Coyote, and humor, I want to toss it back to you about beaver humor, and Dorothy's encounter with beavers, tricks and humor and wit, and
Yeah.
expanding our understanding of all these creatures, and come back to what is intelligence. But I mean, what I worked out is, like, all right, with any cross species engagement, it wants to be a democracy. I give up this, but you get this about this about that, and that's, I guess, a little bit. I mean, Dorothy said, you live with me, and I'll tell your story. But that's kind of a deal, which she did, and they seemed pretty happy. But were you, were what did you find out about if they were imprisoned against their will?
Well, I never could answer that question because it was so long ago, but I did pursue that question because after it was raised, I wondered.
Yeah.
And I dug into it and I didn't see anything in her notes, and she was an honest person, and I think she would have recorded if a beaver had tried to run away, and if a beaver had been unhappy, she would have tried to address that. So I and the people who are now running the sanctuary, Sharon and Owen Brown, and very much her legacy, I talked to them about that. And the beavers really did seem quite happy, the ones that were there. And the ones that were there had been born in captivity. So they weren't wild beavers that had been brought in. The initial kits had been a wild kits that had been brought in very, very young. But then they were generations of beavers that had been born in that house. So, you know, nothing is black and white. It's definitely gray. But I do think it's interesting because we often are looking at animals for the ways in which they are like us. And even framing things in that way, I think we're now at a new revolution in the way we look, not just at animal behavior, but at trees and the forest, with so much exciting work being done by, you mentioned, you know, Paul Stamets and Suzanne Simard and so many people, changing the way we think about the natural world. And it's really, you know, we tend to think about everything in terms of an individual human cognition. And to go back to beavers, you know, one of the fun chapters for me to write, and I spend a lot of time with this question of beavers' intelligence, you know, how smart are they? And I find this researcher at Harvard, the one I write about in the book, and I think she is starting to crack the code of beaver intelligence, because she's reframing the question, not so much is an individual beaver intelligent, but looking at the collective. So she was you know, highly trained engineer at Harvard. In fact, she has done this really exciting work using drones to photograph beaver damming complexes in Montana, and has identified the exact flow rate at which beavers will start to build. So that's an environmental cue that they're responding to. And they don't have recording equipment, but she does. And every time they are going out when the water is exactly 250 liters per second, right? So that's pretty exact. So they're responding to the environment, and they're going out and they're starting to build. So previously it was thought that they responded to the sound of running water. But that doesn't completely make sense, because no beaver tries to build a dam over Niagara Falls, right? So the thinking was the louder the water, the more they would build. But beavers don't do that, because they somehow understand that a strong force of current, even if it's really loud, is too much for them. But we never understood how they knew that. So she was the first one to, I think, actually measure and start to record that. And so then she was in a lab that was studying nature for design and doing a lot with robotics, thinking about swarm technologies and robotics. And some of the researchers there were working with termites and ants and bees. And so I think that got her thinking about that. And so if you think about beavers in more like termites or ants or bees, who are individually not particularly intelligent, but as a collective can do pretty incredible things, because they follow simple rules that are initiated by the environment. It's a form of behavior called Digmergy. Then you start to see beavers in a different way. And, you know, beavers are brilliant, because they construct their world. And as you said, there's no other animal that does that except us. And the largest animal construction in the world, seen by satellite, you know, it's been documented by satellite, is a beaver dam in Canada. It's a half a mile long. So, you know, there are animals that make cool things, like, you know, pufferfish make cool mandalas, octopus make these like walled cities, but they're temporary. But beaver constructions, some of them are 150, 200 years old. So that's a real construction. And it is much more than an individual beaver could do.
Well, in this important thing now, are beavers intelligent? and you mentioned many things that you just mentioned. And then you say, when three or four work together, they can roll a 100-pound boulder and set it in their dam, right?
Right.
And we go, perhaps like ants and bees, they have a kind of intelligence that we as humans simply cannot fathom, right? And let me just toss this to you as, you know, what is unique to our species aside from our rudeness? We go, it might be, you know, our capacity to borrow qualities of intelligence from plants and animals. I mean, you've sort of become beaver-like, don't you think?
Well, I would I would like to think so. I mean, I do think you're right that finding beavers was some kind of a gift. You know, but I've never been so fascinated by any animal before. And I love animals. I've worked with animals all my life, on and off farms and ranches. And I love the natural world. But this beaver really got me. You know, I just, so anyway, and I write about that in the book. But I think I wrote this book also at a time of a lot of, during the pandemic, during a time of loss and change, personal loss, and then just, you know, everything our world is going through. Before the pandemic, any alert person was aware that we were destroying ecosystems at a very fast clip, right? And it seemed like we were just unable to respond, even talk about it coherently. You know, at least we're talking about it now. Whether we're doing enough in time is an open question. But I think I was writing the book in the middle of all of that. And I think, you know, beavers are all about change. They are the Shiva of the animal world. They maybe they destroy a tree and they take that life and then they build this incredible pond and the biodiversity of a pond. I mean, we could talk all day about that. Just the water alone, a teaspoon of water from a beaver pond has 15 times more plankton and microbial life than water from a wetland or a pond or a stream without beavers. So, you know, any wetland is teeming with microbial life, but beaver wetlands particularly. And then there's all the animals that come to a beaver pond. So there's all that biodiversity that happens. So it's pretty, it is this process of, you know, destruction and creation that as humans we're not very comfortable with, right? I mean, if there's one thing we're hardwired to not like, it seems to me it's change. You know,
well, and, right. No, and, but, and then, as my listeners know through the years, I would mention the antics of Stella Coyote. But you mention a lot the gaze that really creates intimate relationship between us and an animal. And living intimately with the beavers as Dorothy did. But, you know, I discovered sort of backstage, you know, that coyotes destroy many things, but also incredible architecture. Stella Coyote, you know, put a keystone rock in the archway of her den and then lined it anyway. Mm. So she invented the flying buttress. So all these sort of marvels going, oh, we didn't know.
Yeah.
And I think that's a wonderful part of your book's contribution. It's like the more we know, the more respect. And, you know, and part of our skills right now is to be able to say to people, did you know about this? Did you know about beavers?
Yeah.
You know, fireproofing the land, yeah?
Well, I think, you know, for listeners who are in urban situations as well as maybe suburban or exurban, you don't have to be in a very rural situation like the one I live in to have beavers around you. Beavers are everywhere, and they're so adaptive. They will make do with what they've got. And I think the other thing is that there are so many, there's so much advanced information now about how to manage what they do. So beavers can be a pest in the wrong place because if they flood someone's septic, you know, that can't be, right? That can't be allowed because we have infrastructure in places and that person's not going to leave their house so a beaver can live there. But although it might be a good idea in some instances, but that's just not going to happen, right? But there are pond levelers and devices called beaver deceivers that can be put into beaver ponds to keep the water from flooding over. And there are trapezoid-shaped devices to protect culverts. And so there's a lot that can be done to keep beavers in the landscape. And I think there are places like out in California, Martinez, this wonderful city where they have kept the beavers right there in town, and learned that not only could they keep the beavers there, but now they have all these people coming there. They have a whole beaver festival. They've discovered that there's a whole kind of wildlife recreation aspect to having beavers among them. So it's increased the quality of life, and there's an economic plus of having those beavers.
And
on top of everything they do, you know.
No, that's part of my highlighted notes from your drawing to a close in this beautiful book, Wildlife Recreation and Martinez. Yeah, they said wildlife creates community cohesion, said Heidi. Crime rates go down, right? So that's very darling in the wildlife. And then from further back, Abijah Mill says beavers can make America beautiful. But I love the wildlife recreation, and as you paint it, with people having their cups of coffee and the beavers coming out, and somebody says, "Do you think he's hamming it up?" And it's like, "Oh, you never know. I think they have a sense of style." Yeah, because the beaver coming out for getting applause, right? And we go, yeah. These are wonderful, wonderful visions.
Thank you. I spent 5 years researching this book, and there were several times when I thought I'm done, and then I realized, no, I wasn't done yet. And then I finally knew when I was done, but I really wanted to keep going until I got the whole picture, because I think there's so many aspects to the story of beavers in North America and our relationship to them. And I think we can learn so much when we look back historically at our relationship to the natural world, maybe through an animal like the beaver, and just kind of walk it forward, because we are at a moment when, if we can fully embrace this new role that the beaver has to play for us, we really can benefit greatly on so many levels. I mean, I really think the U.S. Forest Service should consider a new animal mascot, and that would be Smokey the Beaver. Because beavers help prevent wildfire, and
that's good. That's good. Yes, we'll get right on that.
There's just so much to say about them. And what's interesting, since I think in the last 5 years, studies have accelerated so that things people thought were true, like to go back to Enos Mills, that book was written in 1913, and he had an intuition that beavers could make America beautiful and that beavers could help conserve the river system. But he wasn't a geomorphologist, and his book kind of was lost to history. But now we have a lot of scientists, this whole movement of beaver believers, people really working in the U.S. Forest Service. U.S. Fish and Wildlife has just funded a pilot study out in California. Dr. Fairfax and Dr. Wheaton from California and Utah, they are studying not just can beavers prevent wildfires and make a difference, but how many beavers where? That's a big shift, right? They talk about a practical climate action resiliency plan. So sophisticated people, she's an ecohydrologist, you know, so is he. These are, you know, trained scientists. And fire scientists are studying, okay, how many beavers do we need here to create a speed bump for that wildfire? So, A, we slow the fire down. We know the fire is coming. You know, we have more time. Maybe we have enough resources then to save this or that. You know, that's a big shift in utilization and harnessing of what the beaver can do. I mean, the beaver's not going to do anything for us. They're not like trained dolphins or something. They're just going to do what they do. But if we can coexist with them, if we can give them enough habitat, if we can, you know, out here in the crowded East, there's so many things we could do to create more habitat for beaver pretty easily, as well as educate people about what they do so they just leave them alone. And that would be a huge step forward.
I used to have beaver here. I lived 3 minute walk to the Potomac River, and it was and then they've gone away. And I feel as you did too, going, oh, they've gone away. But apparently, I
Yeah.
had a wolf dog then, and the beaver would always whack its tail. But even if the dog we were just going by it was like it was sort of like it wanted a challenge, right? And I was like, no, Moondog, don't go in the river with the beavers, who's more equipped for water than you are.
Yeah.
But yes, but I do like humor that because once it was dark and the beaver was whacking, and I heard a giant splash of dog going into water. I'm like, oh no, oh no, oh no! And I was looking, and I swear, dog actually tiptoed up behind me, going, "You worried about something?" And I swear the beaver laughed too, going, jokes across species. But you do finish your wonderful book, and every part of it is worth. We could do a radio show on every paragraph, really, because it ties to everything. Your friendship with Herb the Trapper, which is challenging, but you mentioned that it's an incentive for hunters and trappers to protect habitat, right? And so working with everything, and then the whole, conundrum about hunting, but in what way? So
Yeah.
cooperating with everything. But
Well, I think also, if I may, I that sort of begins the book because when, spoiler alert, I hope some of the listeners will pick up Beaverland and read it.
definitely.
My beavers disappear, and that's I set on a quest to find out what had happened to them. And where I live in my adopted home of northeastern Connecticut, the people who knew the most about beavers and cared the most about them were the trappers, the fur trappers. And they just blew my mind that there were even fur trappers. I was like, what? They're fur trappers? This is like an hour from where Martha Stewart got her start. I couldn't believe it. This is Connecticut, although it's a very rural part of the state. And I was very wary at first, but when I got to know Herb, I saw we had much more in common than we realized, or I realized. And while I never became a fur trapper, I did learn to respect greatly the knowledge he had about beavers, because to trap an animal, you really have to understand that animal and its environment. And he spent most of his time lobbying for wildlife conservation. But, that aside, I found the whole enterprise interesting on another level that I respected, because Herb and the other trappers I got to know were very interested in having a relationship to the natural world that they felt was very elemental. And if you think about it, that is our most basic relationship to the natural world, which is nature as food, right? So he was spending hours and hours and hours trapping one individual beaver for its pelt and for its meat, and then he was going to harvest every part of that animal. So if anything, he philosophically identified with a kind of locavore movement, and also with just a way of being in the natural world that he felt was important in light of how disconnected our modern world is from the natural world. So I found that really
Right.
paradoxical, because
No,
I was
we want
concerned about this,
complexity. I'm going to have to reluctantly release you in a moment so that I can pitch to keep this show and the radio station on the air so we can have you back.
Okay.
I
Yeah,
really do hope
great.
so because you go so you weave it together so skillfully. You are a great storyteller, and your understanding of Herb the Trapper and protecting habitat and humility, and then you even get into libertarianism and Robert Bly on the men's movement. I mean, or Herb does, and we go, it covers everything. But if you have just one last blessing wish to spiral out into the airwaves, in a very short time, what would that be?
Well, I just think the book ends with this image. I studied ceramics in Japan of kintsugi,
Ah,
which is
yeah, I
this
love that.
way in which when a bowl is, I studied ceramics, and when a bowl is broken, you repair it with gold, and then it is even more valuable than before. And I think beavers are doing that. They are repairing our, they're like our seams of gold, repairing our damaged river system. that's the way I think we need to think of them.
That's beautiful. All right, I'm going to reluctantly release you so I can do the pitching,
thank
but
you.
Thank you so much for your work and your dedication and your embodiment and your advocacy. It's a beautiful book. I will exhort everybody to pledge for it and then to buy it as well for their library. But thank you very much, Lila Phillip.
Thank you so much. Good night.
Yes, that's great. Okay, team, so wonderful. We are offering this wonderful book, really, really so rich, and again, 5 years in the making, Beaverland, How One Weird Rodent Made America by Lila Phillip. That's for a pledge of $150 or $15 a month. We have just so many things to offer as incentives and thank yous. We also have from the Visionary Activist archives, we've put together a pretty, I would pledge for this, The Intelligence of Our Flora, Fauna, Fungi Kingdom, Dedicated Voices Guiding Our Rogue Species to Collaborative Humility. It's for a pledge of $100 or $10 a month. It's 11 recordings, 2 recordings with herbalist Stephen Buhner. We wave to him. He's getting ready to go backstage. We love him. 4 with mycologist Paul Stamets. My Janine Benyus interview from way back, 2008. It's so good. Sally Cox, advocate for bonobos. Ben Goldfarb, also on beavers. Dan Flores on coyotes. He will be a guest again on January 19th. Kristen Olson, whom we had recently, and on. And so so all of those recordings, I can go into greater detail, but I'm going to pause for the moment here. And then there's a whole lot of related things that, you know, again, we are pledging to be voices for our kin that are also available. So Fantastic Fungi, How Mushrooms Can Heal, Shift Consciousness, and Save the Planet by Paul Stamets. It's the film's official companion book for a pledge of $200. Fantastic Fungi Community Cookbook by Eugenia Bone for a donation of $200. A masterpiece, The Fantastic Fungi Cookbook, is by far the best culinary guide to cooking and pairing mushrooms. This book makes me so hungry I want to eat it, says Paul Stamets. And we go, yes. So Fantastic Fungi Combo Pack, both books by Paul Stamets and Eugene Bone for a donation of $365. Oh, sure. A California Guide to the Birds Among Us for a pledge of $150. Ways of Being, Animals, Plants, Machines, The Search for Planetary Intelligence for a pledge of $150. Oh, it goes on and on. So again, 1-800-439-5732 or online kpfa.org. So again, Lila Phillip's fabulous book, Beaverland, for a pledge of $150 or $15 a month. That'll be really good. The really super great audio collection. We really had a good time putting this together. And some Paul Stamets things you haven't heard. From many places. Oh, let me just, I'm scrolling here. So we have Stephen Buhner, Medicine Abounds, All of Nature Wants to Heal Us, from November 2007, whose book, The Lost Language of Plants. It is so good. It is so good. We honor our almost ancestors. It guides us to reanimate an informed intimacy with the world. That's what we're here to do. That's what we're here to do, team. There's so much, you know, mythic news, beauty, just everything speaking to us, world alive with stories. So even, you know, the moon covering Mars at full moon next to the Pleiades. Pleiades important in all mythologies. In the Ukraine, the Pleiades are the 7 women tribal leaders. And we go, plus, you know, the full moon. But the moon passing in front of Mars, it's how humans discovered that Mars was further away from the moon. Millennia ago, and we go, oh. But it's a lovely image story that Mars is pouring through the moon. What kind of Mars? And it's like, through Big Mama, protect Mars. So we here, everyone, dedicated listeners, you know, again, to form our alliances with what we love, to save as much life as possible, to become like what we want to protect beavers, become more like beavers and adopt their strategies. And that's why this book is so useful, going, oh, you know, and to expand our species' narrow view of intelligence and to go, oh, around us. And that's what all of the people we're offering really do, going, we live in a wonder. It's time to reweave our kinship treaties. And it's the only way we can do this. we as a species have unleashed so much cruelty, on our kin that we can't solve it by ourselves. It's by ourselves that got us into this pickle. Only biomimicry, really, only by reweaving the fabric of intimacy with our plant and animal allies can we pull this off. It's a necessary miracle. But we take heart from coyotes, against all odds, from the beaver humor and ingenuity, from everything. Pledge on behalf of what you love. There we go. That's really what it's 800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And then we thank Anonymous in Forestville. Thank you. I will read that note. And other people to thank. Right. And then thank you, Elizabeth Beth in Walnut Creek. Wonderful. You will love the book, Beaverland. Thank you so much, team. So let's move it on up. So again, the intelligence of flora, fauna, kingdom, dedicated voices guiding us to humbly cooperate, to make a deal, to be advocates for the wild that we love in human culture. That's part of our pledge. Everything real is also symbolic. The essence of any ritual is any physical thing we do that we imbue with dedicated symbolism. And making a pledge to KPFA and to the Visionary Activist Show, 26 years on the air, holy moly. But with many, like in our collection, again, people who are dedicated, who have so much to contribute, guiding and biomimicry and sane reverence and curiosity in redemption. It's all one story, And just to say again, what we're offering for a pledge of $100 is our audio collection, 11 recordings, Stephen Buhner, Medicine Abounds, Stephen Buhner, Cahooting with the Choreography of Creation. Whoops, never mind that. There we go, that's the wolf. That's the wolf encouraging us to pledge. And then we have Paul Stamets, Democratic Animism, Mushrooms Saving the World, If We Cahoot, from December of 2015. We have Paul Stamets, 2014, How Mushrooms Can Save the World. And that's a full hour and 10 minute of backstage conversation that didn't make it onto the radio. There we go. And then October 20, 2008, and then November 2005, and then Janine Benyus, 2008, Sally Cox, 2018, How We Become More Like What We Love to Protect as Much Life as Possible. Well, these themes are consistent: to protect the bonobos in their forest in the Congo, honoring our yearning for animistic participatory embrace. And we go, yes. And then a very recent one, but really good, and segues with today really well, Ben Goldfarb and Beaver Believers. We go, oh, that's great. Dan Flores from January 2018, author of Coyote America, and he will be a guest again with his new book on January 19th. So keep this all going here. Kristen Olson, Sweet and Tooth and Claw, recent but wonderful. And quoting Darwin's contemporary, the Russian scientist, anarchist Peter Kropotkin, pledge for Kropotkin. Who are the fittest, those who are continually at war with each other or those who support one another? Pacifica Radio, Pacifica, goddess of peace. We at once see that those animals which acquire habits of mutual aid are undoubtedly the fittest. And so, absolutely. Oh, thank you so much, Anonymous in Millbrae, California. That's really good. Let's keep this rolling here. This is an act of magical, ritual, mutual aid, to give and to receive and spiral forth, reciprocal blessing. And it's part of all of us really right now at these powerful times. We know the full moon lunar eclipse election was pretty good. And we averted the most horrible Nazi authoritarian catastrophe. And now the horrible Nazi catastrophe is, down to a manageable size. If we cahoot, right? And Raphael Warnock, I think he will unfurl to be a really great, well, Black Gospel King Arthur, convening the round table of ingenious solutions. All of these things, we're all in this dream together. This is, I'm the Caroline Casey part of you, you're the everything, the Anonymous in Millbrae, the Anonymous in Forestville, the Jerry in Santa Rosa. Oh, no, he was pledging for the previous show, but that's okay. We'll take credit for it anyway.
That's okay. I'm here actually, Caroline, now. And like, did I hear you say, is it 26 years?
It's 26 years. I know, it's just amazing.
That's amazing. That alone is a great reason to go to kpfa.org and donate during this hour and support KPFA and support this great show. Yeah, that's amazing. I didn't realize that you have been on the air that long.
No, nobody does. But there are, that's wonderful. Thank you, Laura, for chiming in and exhorting our fund drive captain, because we also want to thank, you know, everybody. I love the board ops. I love Kirsten Thomas. These are all important teammates. It's a community. It's a community for community. Right, and so again, we're offering this really, really fabulous book, Beaverland, for a pledge of $150, and the audio collection that my wonderful ally Aaron and I, you know, culled, going, ooh, these are all really great, you know, again, Stephen Buhner and Paul Stamets and everybody, again, voices for sanity and for cooperating with nature and for animals and plants, and that's part of what the show in Pacifica is. It's a voice for those that don't have a voice, including, you know, animal allies. So, woof woof, 800-439-5732 or kpfa.org online.
That audio collection sounds amazing. The intelligence of our flora, fauna, fungi, kingdom.
kingdom. Right, yes. Yeah.
Because we are all kin.
Right. Well, yeah, we suck the G out of kingdom and spit it out to where it belongs. And the kingdom of heaven is at hand. So dedicated voices. And for everybody to kind of ramp up. I mean, we're heading into, you know, it's dangerous, right? The worst danger alleviated. So we have a coyote chance, a trickster chance of pulling off Renaissance. And with so many great guests over 26 years and now... you know, these are the solutions, and again, to have leadership, Saturn leadership, to implement ingenious solutions. That's certainly part of what this station is dedicated to. I love, you know, the book, you know, ends, you know, Laura, Lila Phillip, you know, so full, and I hope pledge money so we can have her back. But she ends it by saying, we could slow the rate of our planet's warming if we acted fast enough to start reducing the global emissions of carbon, but we could only prevent more damage. We are facing a future in which we will all witness loss and change in the places we love. And it was foolish to ignore this, but it was just as foolish to relinquish hope. As a species, we humans have our flaws, and beavers weren't going to solve our environmental problems. But when it came to water, the lack or overabundance of which that was certainly going to define our future, beavers make a difference. There we go. So pledge for that. Pledge for water. 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. Horacio in Sacramento, thank you so much. Thank you. I love this program. Steve and Duncan Mills, bless your heart for a KPFA unisex black T-shirt. You are my favorite eager beaver who gives a damn barnacle logic. Anyway, thank you so much. That's wonderful. We're getting up there, but let's keep it going. Let's make four figures. Come on, team. 1-800-439-5732 or Laura, your most beguiling and magnetizing pitch as we're about to close down here.
Yeah, it looks like we just have to keep asking. Please support this wonderful radio station that brings you Caroline Casey every week.
There you go.
1-800-439-5732 and kpfa.org.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Laura, and thank you always, Kirsten Thomas. I'm Caroline Casey. We will reconvene next week. Thank you, team. Keep pledging. Oh, here's somebody pledging, even right now. 1-800-439-5732. We will reconvene next week. Thank you, team. Thank you, Laura. Oh, yeah.